I get the impression that Stephen Gowans might be on the line. Are you there, Stephen?
I am. Hello, Phil.
Hi. Stephen, you've written, I want to remind everybody, two really important books. The second one will be coming out soon. The first one is Washington's Long War on Syria, and you have a book coming out soon titled Patriots, Traitors, and Empires, The Story of Korea's Struggle for Freedom. I believe that book is expected in April or May. Here we have both those your favorite subjects. I was just mentioning on air that Washington and I think maybe Paris have suggested that the North Koreans are providing chemical weapons to Syria, and it seems to be inviting a kind of a foreign policy twofer, two states that the U.S. is unhappy with acting in collusion, illegal collusion with chemical weapons. Have you followed that story? What does that tell us about American foreign policy, I guess?
Yeah, that's an interesting story in so many ways. I mean, obviously the intent is to defame both Syria and North Korea, both of which are targets of U.S. and Western foreign policy. And the defamation is done by making allegations, which if you do even some cursory examination, we'll discover that the allegations are not backed by any evidence. It seems that what they do is you figure out an allegation that's going to, you know, undermine or defame a target, and then you try and marshal information that seems to be consistent with that allegation without actually proving it. So when the New York Times wrote about this allegation, if you read the New York Times article closely, you would have seen near the end of the article this line that said, well, experts who had examined this report said that it presented no evidence that proved the claim that was being made. Mm. But I've seen this, you know, multiple times, and the U.S. administration has alleged that Syria had been using chemical weapons on a number of occasions. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the documents that the U.S. intelligence community puts together and puts on the public record, it'll say somewhere, well, there's no proof. There's no smoking gun. But we believe that they did this.
Yes. And we refer you to the photograph next to this story, which shows the other guy looks really evil.
Yeah. Or they'll say something like, well, knowing the Syrian government, they probably did this.
Yes.
But we have no proof.
We're going to try to weave these two topics together because, as I say, you have the two books. And again, it's Stephen Gowans. It's gowans.wordpress.com. We were just speaking earlier to Vanessa Bealey and about the situation in this area called East Ghouta, a suburb of Damascus. Uh-huh. And one of the things I notice is that the way that the political leaders in Canada talk, and the U.S. too, is to say, you know, this war has just going on for so long and it's somebody's got to do something. But in fact, Syria has been doing something, have they not? My impression is this may be very close to strategic moment in terms of being able to say that they basically control Syria.
Yeah, and the idea is someone has to do something to stop the hell.
Prevent them from controlling their own country.
Yeah, but I mean the way it's presented is to provoke this outrage. There's a hell that's been produced in East Ghouta and something must be done. This is really interesting because there are hells produced in a number of places by U.S. forces and their allies, and no one cried about that. In fact, they celebrated it. So they celebrated the siege of Mosul, which essentially led to the destruction of the city. They celebrated the siege of Raqqa, which led to the destruction of the city. Mm-hmm. Likewise, Kobani. Kobani, 70% of Kobani was destroyed. There was a celebration about that. There was a celebration about the liberation of Ramadi, 70% destroyed. Fallujah, both recently was liberated by ISIS, but destroyed in doing so. And interestingly, too, Tal Afar, which was an Iraqi city, in 2005, the current U.S. National Security Advisor, H.R. McMaster, was leading counterinsurgency operations there, and he ordered massive airstrikes and artillery bombardment of Tal Afar, destroying 60% of the city. That was celebrated as a great military victory, but it was creating a hell in Tal Afar. Or we might point to Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, who, said, well, civilian casualties are a fact of life in this sort of situation, which you have urban warfare. But
And when he says that, the New York Times and the Washington Post and CNN all nod sagely, yes, tough, yeah, but we have to do it.
And no one laments that he or his forces or U.S. forces created a hell. And what they don't point out either is that, most of the car bomb attacks in Damascus and the constant shelling across the center of the capital for the past 4 years have come from Islamist forces in Ghouta. Mm-hmm. Robert Fisk, the British journalist, has pointed out that they never show you either, the Islamist fighters in East Ghouta firing off shells and artillery. All you see in television, pictures are the civilian casualties. So this is, this is just an attempt to manipulate people's emotions to provoke outrage, so that you can ask what or something must be done. What must we do?
Somebody has to do something. I actually, before coming to the show, I checked out the headlines and I found the usual one. France must draw a red line in Syria. Trump must draw a red line. And you say, I guess that red stands for blood, but I mean, it doesn't.
No one ever asks what it is that they expect.
And what would they do? I mean, if you're worried about civilian lives, any attempt by a superpower to put its paw in there would definitely lead to a lot of lost lives. Because you outlined what they did with Raqqa and what they did with Mosul. And since they're superpowers, they like to use their high-powered equipment.
Mm-hmm. But we can invite, ask the question, what is it that they would like the Syrian government to do? Mm-hmm. I mean, you continue to tolerate the car bomb attacks in Damascus and the constant shelling, but, when occasionally Hamas fires a few rockets from Gaza and the Israelis respond by leveling Gaza or a few buildings in Gaza.
Yeah, I don't see that phrase, the right to self-defense.
No, I mean, yeah.
NDP would immediately, in the Liberal Party, all went out and met the reporters and said, well, we're worried about what's going on there, but that's, remember, Israel has the right to self-defense. Well, doesn't Syria have the right to self-defense?
No, exactly. But, we could invite the question, so what is it that the Syrian government is supposed to do? At one point, recall Assad asked, what do you want us to do, shoot balloons? Is that, sure. Yeah. I mean, you could say, well, maybe you should sit down with the Islamists in Ghouta and try and arrange some kind of detente. But they have tried to talk to the rebels or the Islamist rebels, and they refuse.
Yeah, I'm very glad you raised that. Gowans, by the way, the Stephen Gowans, gowans.wordpress.com, because the last, there have been efforts since clearly from Moscow's side, and then they had a group of states met. And as a matter of fact, at one point, the U.S. claimed they liked that. They said, oh, it's good, you're having these meetings. But the so-called rebels would say, okay, we're going to come. And then 24 hours before the meeting, they'd announce they're going to walk out. And some of the journalists reported that all of the participants make their headquarters or their offices are in Saudi Arabia. These are the Syrian opposition guys.
Mm-hmm.
And, a conscientious state would say that, like Canada and others, would say these people are not they're not ready for honest talks. And we would ask their sponsors, since somebody's paying their rent in Saudi Arabia, to talk with them. But that hasn't happened.
No.
Actually, Stephen, I got to tell you, I was just maybe it landed on my desk, as they used to say. The statement from the NDP on the situation in Syria, it ends with this comment. We urge Canada, with its new feminist foreign policy, to fund women's activists on the ground in Syria. There are countless stories of women activists in Ghouta creating soup kitchens, leading hospitals, and organizing in the communities. Canada must also fund justice and human rights investigators to ensure crimes committed during this war will be prosecuted. Well, at any rate, I mean, is the NDP reading the newspapers, or where do they get an idea like this, the one they just described? Yeah.
Well, some have called these people the beautiful souls. They don't have a realistic plan for anything. All they want to do is virtue signal. I mean, talk about how they deplore violence against civilians and civilian casualties, as everyone does, but they don't have any kind of realistic solution to the problem or even recognize what the problem is. Mm-hmm. I mean, the suggestion is the problem is Assad. The problem isn't, as you said, I mean, Islamist rebels funded by the Saudis,
A declared goal of a caliphate.
Exactly.
And that isn't really feminist friendly, according to the data. I just found it remarkable. They had other language. The only two states they recognize as being involved, or they said Syria and Russia have to uphold the ceasefire. Well, how about the guys they're shooting at, the ISIS?
Yeah, well, that's interesting, too. There's supposed to be an exception in the ceasefire for al-Qaeda and ISIS. But I find it interesting that the distinction is drawn between ISIS on the one hand and Islamist rebels on the other, who are now just called the opposition, maybe so that we can forget that they're Islamist rebels and are essentially the same as ISIS. The only difference between them and ISIS is that ISIS is less willing to cooperate with the United States than these other Islamists are.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no real distinction between ISIS and the Islamists in terms of their methods, in terms of their goals, in terms of their orientation. So this distinction is completely spurious.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a useful one. It's one that I called, this is part of this management of democracy. So we can talk about how we have a wonderful democracy and how it works well. And it works well by managing people's perceptions or managing public opinion. And one of the ways to do that is to mislead people. And knowing that, most people don't have the time to investigate certain things like when the French and the U.S. government and others make this allegation that the North Koreans and the Syrians are cooperating and recreating a chemical weapons capability of Syria.
Because they're evil. It's the axis of evil doing that.
Well, and how many people really have the time to examine whether there's any evidence behind this claim? They don't have much time, so they simply accept it, and their perceptions are manipulated, and then you can have a wonderful democracy in which the people at the top can do whatever they want because they've managed public perception.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of it. I mean, making this spurious distinction between ISIS on the one hand and, say, the Army of Islam, which is one of the big groups in Ghouta, on the other, is just part of, mm-hmm. poisoning public opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Poisoning public opinion against governments that you want to overthrow because why? Because they're unwilling to subordinate themselves to U.S.
Yeah.
supremacy.
It is interesting. They've created a number of groups which, I feel very much pedestrian on this. They, to me, are just alphabet soup, of IS, and then there's the three or four others with a bunch of letters that I can't make out. And then they'll tell us, well, but they've now emerged, or now there's a – but if we use that old line from Washington where they say, follow the money, the guy paying them is the same guy. So there's 101 guys getting paid with different names, but it's Washington and Saudi Arabia, Paris and London to a certain extent. But they seem – so one assumes the piper still calls the tune. You've done this for us before, and I have to ask you again. You've laid out what it is about Syria that the U.S. has – really wants to get rid of, and reminding that the targets, Libya, Syria, have been secular governments.
Yes, secular Arab nationalist governments, which are anti-colonial, anti-imperialist. They say that they want independent governments that can overcome the underdevelopment, which is the legacy of colonialism, that they're not prepared to subordinate themselves to the United States to become part of the U.S. empire. Mm-hmm. And that is why the United States has been waging a long war against Syria and waged a long war against Libya and wages a long war against other countries as well, who also insist on their independence and sovereignty, such as North Korea.
Mm-hmm. By the way, are they trying to create something which they claimed at the beginning to be against? It has not been real. And matter of fact, some of the better studies recently have shown it's still not real. They claim that, well, Iran is moving in and Russia. But neither Iran nor Russia was doing anything in Syria when these terrorists began to attack the Syrian government.
No. I mean,
so they aren't. So they're there now legally by invitation, as opposed to Washington.
In opposed to Washington, which is there illegally on two grounds. I mean, both internationally in contravention of international law, and there's no dispute about that. And also, I mean, it has dubious legal justification domestically for its actions in Syria. There's really no authorization for the use of military force in Syria. I mean, there was this tenuous authorization based on going back to 2001, based on the fight against Al Qaeda, which was then extended to ISIS. But since the U.S. continues to claim that ISIS has been largely defeated, on what grounds, based on U.S. law, does it continue to operate within Syria?
Mm-hmm.
And it's essentially occupying or holding territory west of the Euphrates. And here, again, we manipulate public opinion by saying this is held by the Kurds. Well, the Kurds are simply a proxy force of the United States. It's not held by the Kurds. Mm-hmm. The Kurds are just doing the dirty work of the United States. And the Kurds wouldn't be holding that territory if they didn't have U.S. support and the backing of the U.S. Air Force and U.S. Special Forces and U.S. artillery.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We're speaking, by the way, to Stephen Gallens, gallens.wordpress.com. A new book is going to be coming out, Patriots, Traitors, and Empires, A Story of Korea's Struggle for Freedom. And by the way, Korea fits the same profile in that sense that they were talking about, the axis of evil. The Koreans in North Korea, and it rather appears South Koreans too, are rather tired of being dictated to by great powers. And I wonder, what do you make of this latest development where the South Koreans and the North Koreans actually were able to put the teams together? To me, that was remarkable in a very short period of time. One day I think, well, put my fingers in my ears because something's going to blow up, and the next day they're there together in the Olympics. It does show a desire for unity and peace among the Korean people, doesn't it?
Yes, and I think that's been there all along. But I think a lot of the optimism about the talks between the South and North is misplaced, because I think the real issue is the tension between the United States and North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
The South Koreans don't want to become dragged into the war that the United States is driving toward, which makes them more amenable to talking to the North Koreans. But even then, I mean, the kinds of talks that they're trying to organize, I mean, the South Koreans aren't going to, they may be talking to the North Koreans, but they're talking about how the North Koreans ought to talk to the U.S. and how they ought to talk about denuclearization, which I think is a dead end. It's certainly the end to which...
Well, yes, we're getting a consensus of major powers. Certainly, well, China and Russia have both said, you know, we don't find we have a counterpart to talk to. They say it's getting to the point where they don't know what the U.S. actually wants, thinks, intends to do. So it's hard to talk, isn't it?
Yeah, well, there's nothing to talk about because, I mean, the United States has no incentive to talk. The United States has a goal, which it's had since 1948 when North Korea was established, which is to bring about the demise of North Korea. And North Korea doesn't threaten the United States in any way. So the United States has no incentive to talk or to come up with any kind of peace treaty arrangement with the North Koreans. And I think anyone who thinks that there's going to be some kind of peace treaty or detente is really... I'm hoping for something that's not going to happen.
Do you anticipate that that they will act on this little thought they've been running recently, which is they might intercept some ships? Because that would be a fairly dangerous thing to do.
I think they will continue to escalate military pressure. That will happen forever. I can't really see... I mean, if there were talks, the United States has been saying, okay, if we're going to have talks, what we're going to talk about, North Korea, is you denuclearizing.
And surrendering, yeah.
And then the North Koreans say, we're not going to denuclearize. What, are you crazy?
Yeah.
And so where did
this go? By the way, you must have noticed that the Western media was mocking the syntax and the grammar of the North Korean English language response. I don't know if you saw that, but somehow they think that they have to be always in this super superior attitude where, you know, they do issue statements, say, don't be stupid. We're not going to do that, you know, which I like that. I mean, that's, I understand that language.
Yeah. I mean, the South Koreans have suggested maybe as a starting point that the North Koreans can suspend their nuclear program. Okay, well, that's fine, but I'm not sure that the United States is going to find that acceptable as an arrangement.
Well, the trade-off would have to be no more military exercises on the border, right, three or four times a year, as you've described quite vividly in your writings and in interviews with us.
Right, which the United States will never agree to because that would militate against their longstanding goal of bringing about the demise of North Korea. So, Frank, I mean, on numerous occasions, the North Koreans have beseeched the Americans for a peace treaty, and the Americans always dismiss them and say, we don't do peace treaties. We don't do those kinds of things. So why anyone would think that because the North Koreans have nuclear weapons that the Americans are going to be more amenable to a peace treaty is beyond me, because the Americans know that the North Koreans will never use those nuclear weapons, certainly not offensively. They would only ever use them in retaliation and knowing that once they use them, they would be completely exterminated.
Yeah. Well, now that brings in President Putin because he issued a statement recently and it seems to be kind of related to that. You say that, of course, North Korea has those weapons for self-defense. And indeed, we're in a kind of a dangerous psychological moment here where some people say, well, now would be the time to hit them before they were to increase their capacity. But in the case of President Putin, he went out of his way to say clearly, look, don't get any ideas about how you could hit us and shut us down. That's not going to happen. Anybody hits us, they're going to pay the price.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now, that's something that is not within the range of North Korean That's not their language, as far as I know. But that this new period that we're in, these matters now are always related, are they not? I mean, part of Putin's statement was also any friend of ours or ally that you would think about harming with a nuclear weapon, you have to understand that would be a blow against us. Is that your reading of what he's saying?
Yeah, but I'm not sure to what extent he would spring to the defense of North Korea. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not sure that the Chinese would either.
If with the introduction of nuclear weapons, I hate to be talking such chilling subjects, but haven't they said that you're not to bring nuclear or even think about nuclear activity toward North Korea?
Yeah. I don't know. I'm not aware.
If I can get him on the phone, I'd say, you better say that.
but one of the things we often lose sight of is obviously a nuclear activity is horrific, but the United States can generate horrific outcomes without nuclear weapons as well. Mm-hmm. And that's something we often lose sight of. I mean, the United States already incinerated North Korea between 1950 and 1953 using conventional weaponry, and that was a long time ago.
Yes.
You can do it much faster today.
Yes.
And I'm not sure that they would reach for their nuclear sword or that they even have to.
Mm-hmm. I was impressed with how well they did, the North Koreans, in terms of handling this sort of the Olympic episode. It is a small matter, somewhat cultural, but they did demonstrate that they have a lot of things in that society that the rest of the world didn't know they had and didn't lives that people didn't understand much about them. Have looked maybe a little more closely at them. Describe, again, as we did with Syria, what is it about North Korea that the U.S. Thinks ought to change?
The U.S. hostility to North Korea is related to the reality that the North Koreans want the Americans off the Korean Peninsula.
Mm-hmm.
And the Americans have no intention of exiting the Korean Peninsula because it's effectively a stationary aircraft carrier, or what they call the largest power projection platform in the Pacific.
Lovely.
Which they can contain their two great power rivals, China and Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And the North Koreans are really the only effective organized force insisting on the U.S. exit from the Korean Peninsula. And that's, I think, the major reason why the United States is hostile to North Korea and has always been hostile. And the other is because it's a government which refuses to become part of the U.S. empire, refuses to subordinate itself to Washington.
Mm-hmm. Who are they in history in terms of who leads the country and what kind of society are they constructing?
Yeah, and that's another thing. Who leads the country? The country was founded by guerrillas who fought against the Japanese during the Second World War.
Our allies.
Yes, we're allies of the United States. On the other hand,
it was kind of important to remember that. I came from a family that was all fought in the Pacific, so those allies, we liked them.
Yeah, so in South Korea, by contrast, was founded or staffed at its highest levels by people who joined the Japanese military or served in the Japanese colonial police force, Quislings, who are on the other side, the side of the Japanese, who were enemies of the United States in Canada. Two very different kinds of political orientations.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's what we wanted to underline. By the way, Stephen, when is your book going to – and the book is Patriots, Traitors, and Empires, The Story of Korea's Struggle for Freedom. When will this book be available?
I believe it will be available in April.
In April. I've heard that you might be making a tour around. We assume you're going to come to Toronto. We would love to see you.
Yes, I believe that might happen sometime in mid-May.
Yeah. Well, Stephen Gowans, thank you very much. Gowans.wordpress.com. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. Taylor Report, CIT 89.5 FM, facebook.com/The Taylor Report, soundcloud.com, Taylor-Report. And according to Phil Conlon, I got that right. And Byron doesn't seem disturbed by any of this, so I guess we're doing okay for the day. Do follow these stories. Vanessa Beely, Stephen Gowans, excellent writers. Just put their name. Isn't this great about the internet? Just write their names in, and I don't have to point at one thing or another.